situation or stop the war, it won't be the humanitarian situation. It will be the economic hardships that the Saudis are burdened with, and or the need to portray a good image of the new US administration. Because in the end of the day, the US has never bothered to care about humanitarian situations of other nations, except that of Israel. Regardless of what the name of the president
was at the
time.
The Saudi war in Yemen, as you said, it turned into a disastrous quagmire for Saudi de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who has been a strong ally of the Trump administration. We still don't know if he's going to fail to build that much of a strong relationship with the Biden administration as well. However, Biden's foreign policy on the region of West Asia still remains a blank page for now. He hasn't really spoken about that a lot, even in the campaigning time. He didn't really talk a lot about what they call the Middle East. What do you think Mohammed bin Salman is capable of offering to the Biden administration, maybe to keep them a bit away from Yemen?
Well, I don't think MBS Mohammed bin Salman could offer Biden anything that he didn't offer Trump already. Mm-hmm. And yet, the situation of the Saudis in the world changed to the worse. He would probably offer, if he would offer something, the same thing the Saudis always offer the Americans, the only thing they could offer the Americans, and that's money. But you can't buy time forever, regardless of the size of your oil wealth. I think the Biden administration would keep their historical American ties to the Saudis, but the support for the war will weaken for already mentioned reasons. The Saudis are stubborn and wait for a golden opportunity to escape the war, while they try to keep their pride intact. Either that will happen soon, or an escalation by the Yemeni people will force them to retreat. The Yemeni people are truly suffering, Marwa, but they have been very restrained in attacking goals inside Saudi Arabia, except that to Aramco. Mm-hmm. And all these years of fighting have given the Yemeni people good experience. And Ansarullah is a movement now which has evolved from a local movement in Yemen 6 years ago to a huge force that even Israel takes into consideration regarding its national security. And that says a lot.
Exactly.
And I want to finish with what the Yemeni foreign minister, Hisham Sharaf Abdullah, recently said mm-hmm. to Yemeni media. He said, "Those who mobilize their militants towards Yemen with the goal of causing death and destroying its cities and villages cannot expect us to respond by waving at them and sending them flowers and peace dogs."
It is basically the same speech given by every resistance in the region of West Asia against every occupying
exactly.
power and colonizing power that ever tried and dared to make the people, the natives, submissive to the wills of the Western colonial powers. Thank you very much, Firas Ali, for speaking with us, discussing with us the humanitarian crisis in Yemen from Malmo. Thank you very much for being with us. And please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The latest building spree in the West Bank is not just illegal and flagrant violation of international law. Wonder what does it mean? But the very existence of the Israeli regime lacks all legitimacy. To be more precise, the Zionist entity is a cancerous tumor in the heart of the Arab Muslim world and ought to be removed at the earliest from the soil of Palestine. For the sake of peace and stability in the West Asia region, if there is any such term as international law. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Keihan International. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Reports from the usurped land of Palestine say the Gregorian calendar year 2020 that went by saw a record number of new Zionist settlements built in the West Bank River of Jordan on lands seized from the native Arab people. In related news, the UN Secretary General has condemned the Zionist entity's recent plan to construct hundreds of new housing units on Palestinian lands, saying such structures are considered illegal under international law. Antonio Guterres added, "The building by Israel of townships on Palestinian territory occupied since 1967, including East Jerusalem, has no legal validity and constitutes a flagrant violation under international law." Good words indeed, but as toothless as the UN Security Council Resolution number 2334, which for the past 50-plus years has been considered a useless piece of paper by both the Israeli regime and its godfather, the United States of America, which constitutes and continues to award more and more Palestinian and Syrian lands to the illegitimate entity that Britain created in 1948. For the several hundred thousand East European Jews it had illegally settled in Palestine between the two world wars. The latest building spree in the West Bank is not just illegal and flagrant violation of international law. Wonder what does it mean? But the very existence of Israel lacks all legitimacy. To be more precise, the Zionist entity is a cancerous tumor in the heart of the Arab Muslim world and ought to be removed at the earliest from the soil of Palestine for the sake of peace and stability in the West Asia region, if there is any such term as international law. According to the UN Charter, it is the duty of the native people to resist and fight against occupation of their ancestral lands rather than accommodate the occupier and embolden it to encroach upon more lands. In view of this clause, the Palestinian people have the birthright to take up arms against the Zionist regime and continue their struggle till all Zionist settlers, not the original Palestinian Jews, are eradicated from not just the West Bank and eastern parts of Beit al-Muqaddas, but from the every single centimeter of Palestinian soil, and that includes Tel Aviv, Haifa, and all other towns and cities. Irrespective of the current Zionist decision to build some 800 new housing units in the recently confiscated Palestinian lands in the West Bank for Jewish migrants from other parts of the world, or for that matter, the figure given by the UN of more than 600,000 Israelis living in over 230 settlements built since 1967 in defiance of UN Security Council Resolution 2334, it could be said the entire population of 9 million Israelis is living on usurped land. In other words, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the other Palestinian liberation units have a duty to carry on the campaign till their homeland, stretching from borders of Lebanon in the north to the Sinai in the south, and from the River Jordan in the east to the Mediterranean Sea in the west, is emptied of every single Zionist. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has rightly called for a referendum to find a peaceful democratic solution for the chronic question of Palestine, which the UN has unfortunately ignored. If this suggestion is prevented from implementation by the US and Western powers, then the Israeli regime will most surely meet a violent end, perhaps similar to the end of the 88-year illegal existence of the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem in 1187 AD, when a united Muslim force of Kurds, Turks, Arabs, and Iranians liberated Palestinian from European Christian occupation. No amount of treason by ruthless Arab regimes of the spurious states will be able to prevent this eventuality. Meanwhile, let the Israelis continue their building spree of thousands or millions of housing units, which one fine day will indeed return to their rightful owners, the Palestinian people.
Around the world with reporters.
Democrat Joe Biden has been inaugurated as President of the United States, replacing the highly controversial Donald Trump. As a result of entrenched but minority perceptions of electoral fraud, there was not a peaceful transfer of power. The nation's capital was locked down into a fortress with more soldiers than the U.S. uses to occupy both Afghanistan and Iraq. State capitals were similarly swarming with troops nationwide. The inauguration is being called a merciful conclusion to an electoral campaign which seemingly started the day after the election of Trump in 2016 and then the most divisive vote in recent memory. Biden's inaugural speech spoke often of unity and reconciliation, but Democrats and Republicans seem to have been at each other's throats for four consecutive years. How to turn off this mutual animosity may be the most urgent problem Biden faces, but it may also be the most difficult.
47 years of Biden being in politics, that he would actually be able to do what's necessary to heal the country. Unless of course there's some shift in how he sees it, and unless of course there's pressure from the left, like I said, the role of labor, to actually improve the quality of life of working people.
Biden inherits an America which may be at its lowest point in history. America in 2020 combines 1930s economic depression, 1960s cultural division, 1860s concerns with white supremacy, and 1780s questions of political legitimacy. The coronavirus is killing Americans faster than ever. A highly divisive Senate trial of the recently impeached Trump looms. Gun sales and murder records were recently recorded nationwide, and the country remains on high alert for acts of political terrorism to name a few of the worst problems.
If we're not talking about enacting changes that could improve the quality of life immediately, materially for working people, then I don't think that they'll be able to heal. And I'm talking about Biden is talking about return to normal. Well, what's normal?
Both Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are considered to be on the right wing of the Democratic Party. Biden's cabinet is filled with holdovers from the era of Barack Obama, during which Biden was the vice president. Kamala Harris has become the highest-ranking woman ever in American history. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Ansarullah Political Bureau has issued a statement to condemn the U.S. designation of the movement as a terrorist group. The statement was issued after the measure came into effect on January 19th, the last day of President Donald Trump in the office. In its statement, the movement has underlined the atrocity of the U.S. against the nations resisting its adventurous policies, including Yemen. The statement says the blacklisting of Ansarullah movement reveals that the U.S. plays a key role in Saudi-imposed war against Yemen. It calls the U.S. the major enemy of the Yemeni nation.
The American decision and designation was not surprising to us, as it came at the culmination of the U.S. hostilities against the Yemenis, ongoing on for 6 years by two succeeding American administrations. The American administration is the one who is committing acts of terrorism against the Yemenis, and if it reflects negatively on the Yemeni people, there will certainly be a response determined by the leadership.
The U.S. move has also sparked rage among the Yemeni academics and students who voiced their anger in a protest organized by Sana'a University. The protesters denounced the U.S. policies and its continuing crimes against nations. Who have not bowed to Washington's desires.
The Yemeni people of all groups, especially the academics, stand against this classification and they stand with Ansarullah. The blacklisting will not harm Ansarullah as it did not harm Hezbollah and all other free people in the world. Rather, it may harm ordinary Yemenis only. We reject this decision and refuse to call the Ansarullah movement a terrorist group.
Yemenis are concerned that the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansarullah movement may impact the humanitarian situation in Yemen amid the ongoing war that was launched by the Saudi-led coalition in March 2015. The devastating war has so far killed tens of thousands of civilians and injured thousands of others in Yemen, while displacing millions in the country.
Yemenis say the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansarullah movement is an unacceptable move, prompted by the Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. They say the move is aimed at putting more pressure on Yemen, already in dire situation from war and the blockade imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
In July 2020, following the enforcement of new national security laws on Hong Kong by China, the UK announced plans to expand visa rights to Hong Kong residents who claimed British National Overseas or BNO status before Britain handed over its former colony in 1997. Until recently, BNO passports did not give Hong Kong citizens the right of residence in the UK, but Number 10 has now changed the rules.
We made clear, Mr. Speaker, that if China continued down this path, we would reintroduce a new route for those with British national overseas status to enter the UK, granting them limited leave to remain, with the ability to live and work in the UK and thereafter to apply for citizenship. And that is precisely what we will do now.
China and Hong Kong both say this violates the Sino-British Declaration that paves the way for Hong Kong to return to Chinese rule. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam says the BNO is a form of travel document, not a form of nationality.
If one side, and that is the UK government, tries to deviate from that mutual understanding and bilateral agreement, then of course it's legitimate for the other side, that is the Central People's Government, to consider any countermeasures. And the Hong Kong SAR government will of course support any countermeasures to be adopted by the Central People's Government.
UK-China relations deteriorated in 2020. The UK banned Chinese telecom giant Huawei from the build-out of the UK's 5G network. It put forward a proposal to screen and block certain mergers and acquisitions from Chinese investors on national security grounds, and as a former colonial power decided to throw its weight around, declaring China's national security laws on Hong Kong to be a breach of the Sino-British Joint Declaration. On this pretext, Number 10 is offering almost three-quarters of Hong Kong's population a fast-track route to British citizenship, stoking fears of brain drain in the city, especially in its healthcare system. England alone has around 50,000 vacancies for registered nurses, and the COVID-19 pandemic has thrown the NHS's staffing crisis into stark relief. Brexit has made sourcing health professionals from Europe much more difficult, and strict immigration policies also make recruitment from abroad very challenging. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The ground forces of Iran's army kicked off war games along the Makran coasts of the Sea of Oman, southeast of Iran. The drills called Iqtedar or Power 99 started with the participation of airborne units, special forces, and quick reaction units. The troops received logistical and combat support from the Air Force and the Army Ground Forces Airborne Division at the coastal zones in Hormozgan province. A combination of homegrown and creative military tactics was practiced in the offense exercise based on the new structure of the ground forces.
The main purpose of the war games is to evaluate the mobility and offense power of the rapid reaction forces and corps and the mobile offense units of the Army ground forces. We also practice rapid and decisive response to threats on the hypothetical enemy's coasts.
We talked to Iran's Army Commander Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi, who attended the drills, asking him if the extensive war games are in reaction to U.S. deployment of forces to the region in recent weeks.
It seems that the Americans are somehow confused and are suffering from indecisiveness. This is the first time in the U.S. history that they are in a very inappropriate condition. Our drills are generally preemptive, but as they may make some insane moves, we stage these maneuvers to say we are ready against any calculation error by the adversaries.
We also talked to the war games commanders, who gave more details regarding the drills on the land and at the sea.
Our parachuters descended from planes and then got on armored personnel carriers to approach the mock enemy targets and destroy them. In another part of the exercise, some special forces and divers will descend from choppers on the sea surface to get to the beach and fight mock enemy forces.
The Iranian military forces have held several massive maneuvers over the past few weeks. The importance of this year's drills conducted by the Army's forces relies on the native nature of the equipment used in the event. Almost all of the equipment used in the war games this year are homegrown, Human Abedi, JASC.
Amid the recent growing of coronavirus infections in Israeli jails and the medical negligence of Israeli-Palestinian prisoners' conditions, the Palestinian Legislative Council, along with the Ministry of Palestinian Prisoners, held a press conference to express concerns of the serious condition of the prisoners at Israeli jails. Palestinians demanded an urgent action from the international community to save their life.
Our prisoners are dying inside the Israeli jails as the Israeli regime is practicing a slow death policy against them. The Israeli regime doesn't provide the infected prisoners with the required medical care. The international community should step in to save our prisoners' lives.
According to Palestinian Prisoners Organization, over 250 prisoners are diagnosed with the coronavirus, and the number is expected to rise due to the intentional medical neglect at Israeli jails, as Israel has stalled delivery of the vaccine to the Palestinian prisoners. Palestinians also demanded an international supervision to vaccinate the Palestinian prisoners
and make sure they are delivering the required health care.
Palestinian prisoners are facing a serious danger that threatens their lives. Israel is using this virus against our prisoners to put further pressure on them. The coronavirus has already reached a number of Israeli jails and infected almost 250 Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian sources say over 5,000 Palestinians are currently detained in Israeli jails, mostly with no charge. Palestinian resistance has warned that they won't remain silent and hold Israel responsible for the consequences of neglecting the health condition of Palestinian prisoners.
The prisoners' issue is among our top priorities, and we will do our best to set our Palestinian inmates free. The resistance holds the Israeli regime responsible for all the consequences of this dangerous move.
Palestinian detainees have continuously resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to suppress the outrage at the detention. While some 5,000 Palestinian inmates are suffering in Israeli jails amid the coronavirus pandemic, Israel has deprived them from their right to health care. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Quds, the axis of Muslims' unity. This is the theme of the International Webinar of Parliaments Supporting Palestine. Organized by Iran's parliament, the event was attended by parliament speakers and deputy speakers from Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, Indonesia, and other Muslim countries, as well as representatives of Palestine's resistance movements to express their solidarity with Palestinians in their resistance against Israel's occupation. Delegates condemned Sudan, the UAE, and Bahrain for their normalization of ties with Israel, calling it a betrayal to the Muslim community.
It's a bitter tragedy to see that Palestinians' houses are demolished on a daily basis. 2 million Palestinians in Gaza are living in a prison-like area, and 5 million members of the Palestinian diaspora are not given their legitimate right to return to their homeland. What's even more tragic is that some Muslim countries have given the seal of approval to Israel's crimes by establishing political and economic ties with the occupying regime.
We call on the parliaments of all Muslim and Arab countries to take serious measures against the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and especially the unwelcome deal of the century that seeks to change the identity of Palestinians and their land.
The Arab-Israeli normalization came as part of outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump's so-called deal of the century. The plan, which triggered a storm of condemnations from Palestinians, refers to Jerusalem as Israel's undivided capital and recognizes Israeli sovereignty over large parts of the West Bank. While the controversial deal was championed by Trump, observers say the incoming U.S. administration is not likely to change course on Palestine.
For me as a Palestinian and the previous experience of all American presidents, they are, and especially Biden, he's having a big heritage of literature to support the security of Israelis. And he did nothing when he was the vice president during Obama's time for the Palestinian, except that speech and rhetorics, and we have gained nothing.
Palestinian ambassador to Iran says resistance remains the only way ahead of his people against Israel's occupation, since he believes that the path of dialogue does not work with Israel.
We have to unite our forces to be strong front, and all the Arabs and Islamic world will stand behind us. No other way, because they have proved always that they are not loyal to negotiations or to any other settlement with them.
Although the Arab-Israeli normalization infuriated the Muslim world, commentators say it should not come as a surprise, and it's only a revelation of their long-existing covert ties. This is why they believe the move will not lead to a seismic shift in regional power equations.
Delegates at the webinar underlined that Palestine remains the top priority and the innermost issue of the Muslim world, adding that Israel and its Western supporters have spared no effort in derailing that priority. They called on Muslim countries to stay united, as they believe this is the main counterforce against Israel's expansionist agenda. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
2021 has so far been miserable for millions of business people and their staff across the 27-country European Union. Lots of outlets are being forced to close their doors to prevent the spread of COVID-19, with only essential retailers allowed to remain open.
You see that we have stricter measures than even a few months ago all around Europe.
Finance ministers from the 19-nation Eurozone have just concluded their first meeting of 2021 and warned that social inequality in the EU has yet to peak. Government and personal debt is rising due to the pandemic. We are reminded that the bloc has pre-existing economic problems. For example, in Greece, youth unemployment was running at almost 50% even before COVID-19 came along.
Do not forget the situation in Italy, where proper tax system is not in place, and France is facing enormous problems of unemployment.
The EU's spending watchdog, the European Court of Auditors, has been examining the bloc's initial response to the pandemic. During an online interview, a spokesperson told us that better cooperation is required.
Indeed, the EU has to learn lessons going forward, both to react better to the COVID crisis, but indeed to pandemics in the future, because pandemics aren't going away. There will be another one in the future.
EU finance ministers say COVID-19 recovery funding needs to be released without delay and spent wisely by member states. Meanwhile, the bloc's crucial vaccination programme is being rolled out too slowly, many health experts argue. Because the bloc is still in the middle of a health emergency and the start of a new economic crisis, analysts say the EU's response will not be fully assessed by citizens until the pandemic passes. Based on current information, perhaps their verdict will not be good. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
An international rights group says that Israel, as an occupying power, must provide coronavirus vaccines to Palestinians. According to a press release by Human Rights Watch on Sunday, the Israeli authorities should provide COVID-19 vaccines to Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Human Rights Watch Regional Director Omar Shakir said that while Israel has already vaccinated more than 20% of its citizens, including Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank, it has not committed to vaccinate Palestinians living in the same occupied territory under its military rule. Israeli authorities had, as of January 14, 2021, provided doses of the vaccine to more than 2 million Israeli citizens. Close to 150,000 coronavirus infections and over 1,500 deaths have been reported in the occupied West Bank and the blockaded Gaza Strip so far.
Article 56 of the 4th Geneva Convention requires Israel, as an occupying power, to adopt and apply the prophylactic and preventive measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics. The provision of COVID-19 vaccine to Palestinians is the duty of the Israeli occupying forces. Israel bears full responsibility for the health and well-being of people under its occupation.
Palestinians have accused the Israeli regime of practicing medical apartheid against them and committing mass human rights violations. Experts say Tel Aviv must end its discriminatory policies and remove any barriers that may hinder Palestinians from accessing or enjoying health care.
Ban Human Rights Watch.
The statement by Human Rights Watch echoes the position of many international human rights organizations as it exposes the ugly face of the Israeli occupation. It also exposes the grave human rights violation by the Israeli regime, especially violating the health rights of Palestinians. Israel, as an occupying power, must meet its obligations under international laws and norms.
Human rights groups are expressing alarm over Israel's decision not to vaccinate more than 4.5 million Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, depriving them of their right to health care.
Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Austria extends its third hard lockdown until the 7th of February, announcing a new requirement for everyone to use FFP2 or N95 masks in supermarkets and public transport, and extending the minimum distance rule from 1 to 2 meters. The announcement comes a day after thousands took to the streets of Vienna protesting the COVID restrictions. The right-wing FPÖ party, which supports the protests, expressed anger at the decision, warning that people would no longer understand the necessity for the measures and persist in civil disobedience. Officials maintain that they would do the right thing, notwithstanding how popular it will be.
The results of our consultations over the past few days make us anything but happy and also make us anything but popular.
Studies have now shown that the new virus variant first discovered in the UK has been in Austria earlier than was initially suspected, currently affecting around 10% of positive cases.
If the new variant replaces the current virus as the dominant strain, 5 times more cases of illness and death can be expected.
Austria's health minister says the country is currently in the most difficult phase of the pandemic and that the situation is very challenging, at least for the next 10 weeks till the end of March, when warmer weather and more vaccinations can help improve the situation. Around 600,000 people are expected to be vaccinated by then. The goal is to reach a 7-day incidence of 50 new infections per 100,000 people. That number is currently 130.
But there's light at the end of the tunnel, Austria's Chancellor says. With the vaccination campaign underway, officials expect things to look more normal in April or at the latest in May. Homolesky, Vienna.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Epic of 8-Year Holy Defense.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we have said several times that the Iraqi dictator Saddam's main goal of initiating the 8-Year War and invading Iran was to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. He pursued other goals too, but he and his masters in Washington, Moscow, Tel Aviv, and Europe didn't reach any of their goals. For sure, the 8-year imposed war, or the holy defense, was one of the, if not the most important and most fateful periods of after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. It was also one of the most effective events in the region, as its consequences have remained in the region and the world after the lapse of over 3 decades of its end. That 8-year period left such deep impacts on Iran's military, cultural, economic, political, and social life. The 8-year war caused such a great deterrence power to Iran that today, the world powers, especially the United States, are scared of any aggression and evil thought against the Islamic Republic of Iran. Stay tuned for the last episode of this series. The 8-year war, apart from its hardships, destruction, and bitter events, left behind unique epics and unforgettable honors for the Iranian nation and the Islamic world. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, a few months before departure from the mortal world, issued a message, part of which reads,
Every day in the war, we had a blessing, which we have benefited from in all since. We exported our revolution to the world. We proved our innocence and oppression of the invaders in the war. We removed masks from the face of deception of the world devourers. We recognized our friends and foes in the war. We came to the conclusion in the war that we have to stand on our own feet. We crushed the awe of the two Eastern and Western superpowers. We consolidated the roots of our fruitful revolution in the war. We in the war caused the sense of brotherhood and compatriotism to flourish in each of our people. We in the war showed to the people of the world, especially the regional people, that one can fight all powers and superpowers for long years. Our war resulted in the victory of Afghanistan. Our war will result in the victory of Palestine. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said on the support of the West and the East for Saddam during the eight-year war, "Throughout the Cold War era, there had been no issue in which the two world superpowers had such a unison so that both of them gave military equipment to one side. Since the Second World War till the era of the Holy Defense, you cannot find such special conditions. This was an exception that Saddam enjoyed both the unsparing economic, political, and even military support of the West to some extent, and besides, there were the vast military supports of the East. The whole army of Saddam was equipped with the weapons made by the Soviet Union and its East European satellite states, which were inside the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet superpower at that time. This was a strange thing. In this war, we were oppressed in the real sense of the word. Once, one of the officials was explaining that when we wanted to pass across the Soviet soil to import the barbed wire that we had bought from a country, but we were not allowed. It was one of the rare points of the contemporary era that a revolutionary country which had stood against the U.S. would face such restrictions by the Soviets." Dear listeners, the Eastern and Western blocs had come to the conclusion that any revolution with a religious nature would cause serious challenges, there being. Thus, they spared no effort to prevent it from thriving. Moreover, the fake Zionist regime of Israel and the backward Arab regimes in the region became very scared of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, which would put their illegitimate interests at stake. They were afraid of the revolution's turning into a role model for the regional nations, most of whom have not experienced the taste of popular rule and true democracy. Thus, both the West and East threw their weight behind Saddam in all its all-out aggression against Iran, and that only 19 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The eight-year war was imposed on Iran while the Islamic Republic system was still an infant and had not become stable. Furthermore, there were separatist groups here and there in the country. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and Islamic Revolution Committee forces, also with popular volunteer forces, had the mission of maintaining security in the country, and the army had just started tasting the sweet days of independence, while many of its remaining equipment were unusable, as the foreign, mainly American military advisors had left the country. However, 1 year into the war, Saddam's war machine was stopped through the unmatched unity of army, IRGC, and Basij force, and formation of resistance units. By the end of the seventh year of war, Iran turned from defensive into offensive side in the war, in spite of all-out supports of the West and the East for Saddam. Saddam's supporters, especially the United States, seeing his successive failures in the war, intensified their support, and Washington directly entered the war in favor of Saddam in the waning month of the war. In such circumstances, Imam Khomeini, as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, came to the conclusion that accepting the UN Security Council Resolution 598 was to the benefit of the Islamic Republic. The eight-year war was the only war in the history of Iran in which the entire soil of the country was liberated from occupation. Then, as the Imam had predicted, Saddam invaded Kuwait 2 years after the end of the eight-year war and seriously threatened the Arab regimes in the region. Therefore, these regimes expressed regret over their supports for Saddam during his war of aggression against Iran. The eight-year war caused the regional and trans-regional powers to recognize the Islamic Republic and understand that Iran had turned into a big regional power. So, they admitted Iran's power in the regional and even global equations. Thus, the Islamic Revolution went from strength to strength through the selfless steadfastness of its youth. Yet, the United States and its allies, or partners in crime, didn't stop their enmities against the Islamic Republic after the end of the war. Nevertheless, as the enemies have aggravated their hostilities, Iran has become more and more powerful and stable and has made bedazzling breakthroughs in various scientific and military spheres. In some of these areas, Iran ranks among the 10 countries in the world. To mention a few of them, Iran is among the 10 countries which enjoy the full cycle of nuclear fuel for peaceful purposes. It also has gained the capability of launching satellite to the orbit. The Islamic Republic stands among the few countries which have access to the know-how of nanotechnology and stem cells. Iran owes all this to the eight-year holy defense.
Today.
The key to stability in West Asia has very different definitions in American and Persian dictionaries. Iran says stability can be maintained only by regional unity and secured by regional powers. The U.S. appears to see stability in omitting regional powers and sowing discord among neighbors. There's over 11,500 kilometers between the U.S. and Iran. Welcome to Iran Today. I'm Leila Faramarzi, bringing you the topic of stability and instability in the region of West Asia or the Middle East. To put it in U.S. terms, instability is synonymous with Iranian policy in the region. Now, how can that be, given two things? One, the fact that the region is Iran's own neighborhood, and two, recent events unfolding in America show anything but stability in the U.S. itself.
Thank you.
We are talking bearskins and horns in the capital as pro-Trump protesters attacked to overturn election results. Let's hear what Mr. Parkayin has to say. He's our former ambassador and foreign ministry veteran.
Americans are now facing serious instability in their own country, but at the same time, they did not leave our region. This is because the U.S. has managed to remain a superpower throughout its history due to its presence in the Middle East and West Asia. Today, this active presence no longer exists, which is why Western experts themselves consider the absence of the United States in the region as a sign of its decline.
I've brought you to Parliament today for a quick chat with MPs on the topic of stability in the region, its defenders and destroyers.
The U.S. has a specific formula depending on the situation in every country to secure a foothold there, behaviors that are known by the whole world. Everyone knows that U.S. behaviors in a specific way in the Middle East, South America, Africa and Southeast Asia, for example. You can see this country's behavior in the world. It is usually pursuing its own interests under the pretext of creating security in the world. That is, the cover of America's behavior is such that it portrays itself as a defender of the nations, but uses the excuse to safeguard its interests and exploit those nations behind the scenes. Iran is a vast country with a unique and ancient history. We have always been a pacifist.
I've heard advocates of U.S. foreign policy say things like, America dropped the bomb to put a stop to the war, referring to America nuking Hiroshima and Nagasaki in World War II, as if to say the bomb was meant for peace. It gives me confidence in my understanding that to the U.S., it's instability for stability. Whereas Iran has been calling for peace and friendship for stability and safety.
They themselves destabilized the region. As is written in history, they started disintegrating Islamic countries. Their presence in the region is in an attempt to disintegrate great Islamic countries, including Iran, Turkey, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia, although some Arab countries are not mindful of this issue. They plan to disintegrate these countries to make them unable to defend themselves. They want to appear under the pretext of restoring security in the region and defending the regional nations, and at the same time plunder their wealth and resources.
Perhaps stability and security meant something else to the U.S. in its heyday of imperialism, when smaller countries were more cooperative. But today it means securing the stability of U.S. interests at any cost for others. Jimmy Carter, the U.S. president that lost Iran, although he did acknowledge later that Iran was never his to be lost, did laud this country as an island of stability. That was in 1977. Between 1972 and 77, the Shah or Iranian king splashed out on a defense buildup with petrodollars. The price of oil quadrupled in 1973, and he purchased more than $16 billion in arms from the U.S. in 5 years, on top of about $3 billion per year in bilateral civilian trade. As soon as 1979, events took a sharp turn. The Islamic Revolution happened, and as 2,500 years of monarchy were toppled, America's island of stability turned into an island of nightmares. It's not what the US and other world powers expected, but it happened. Iranians had decided being an island of stability was no compliment if the country couldn't decide its own fate without foreign interference.
Oil was nationalized before the revolution. If the nation had waited a little, would things have changed or would Iran carry on with its dependence on the West?
Developments took place, such as a national oil movement during the time of Dr. Mossadegh and Ayatollah Kashani, and a lot of effort was made and the people supported it. But then, when the Americans came back to power and brought back the Shah, they ousted Mossadegh, and in fact, the oil nationalization movement failed. Following that, not only did we remain dependent on the United States, but the Zionist regime also took oil from Iran. The war machine of the Zionist regime was working with Iranian oil. So was South Africa's. That is, the South African war machine against the blacks was also powered by Iranian oil.
A main revolutionary motto of the Iranians was independence. Why did they even feel a vacuum of independence, I asked.
Well, a lack of independence was very tangible before the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The reason being that Reza Shah, Mohammad Reza's father, was brought to power by the British. There is no doubt about it. During the reign of Reza Shah, the whole country depended on three great powers, the British, the French, and the Russian, which divided the country into the north and the south. Russia led Iran's oil in the north, while southern oil was controlled by Britain. France was also taking advantage of Iran.
Having suffered 8 years of an imposed war in isolation, referring to the Iraq-Iran War of the 1980s, Iran has built up its defense industry. U.S. interference and involvement it deems a no-no, an outlook that outgoing U.S. President Trump has justified by making it a habit to go back on deals, namely the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal.
The reports from the US or European forums are mainly focused on our missiles. They always speak about our missiles, and they think that our defense power is limited to our missiles. Now, missiles is only one sector of our defense programs. We're as active in other sectors as we are in the missile sector. For example, ground defense, maritime defense, and underground defense. We're also working on other systems. We see how the world is watching us. But we never neglect our defense capability.
Not to go off on a tangent, U.S. interference, even presence, has been a military presence and intervention. To balance power in the region, America has not settled for having its own boots on the ground even, but has created proxies. Its proxies are not your average militia. Rather, America has admittedly created or supported the most savage terror groups operating in the name of Islam. Yet it fights them, selectively. I say selectively because it, the US, has acted vengefully against Iran, Syria, and Iraq since their successful fight against Daesh, or ISIS. Just before the General Soleimani assassination last year, Iran's leader accused the US of creating Daesh and saying, the U.S. actions in Syria and Iraq were intended to take revenge on the PMU for defeating ISIS, or Daesh. PMU stands for Popular Mobilization Units, an Iraqi state-sponsored umbrella organization. Now, why does the U.S. see Iran a front to its foreign policy?
After all, Americans have always sought to impose themselves on nations and governments through bullying, to pass themselves off as a superpower. The Islamic Revolution has emerged with the slogan of freedom of all nations of the world, but they don't want this slogan to spread. 4 decades after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, we have been able to awaken many of the world's nations with our slogans of seeking justice and freedom. With our own cultural revolution, America doesn't want the awakenings in the oppressed nations.
U.S. propaganda is riddled with controversy. In spite of its sporadic admissions to the contrary, the United States still ostensibly claims it is seeking stability in the world. It claims it is Iran and allies that are seeking terrorism and reducing stability. But history reflects the truth like a mirror. Iran has a no-first-strike policy. It has waged no wars in over 200 years. That's about as long as the US's whole lifespan, nearly all of which has been spent on war. And now it looks on the verge of a second civil war.
When we review the US culture over the last 200 to 300 years, we see that wherever the US has stepped in South America,